Last night we learned the death of Chrysostom and that he was to be buried here, and out of curiosity and pity we left our direct road and resolved to come and see with our eyes that which, when heard of, had so moved our compassion, and in consideration of that compassion and our desire to prove it, if we might by condolence, we beg of you, excellent Ambrosia, or at least I on my own account entreat you, that instead of burning those papers, you allow me to carry away some of them." And without waiting for the shepherd's answer, he stretched out his hand and took up some of those that were nearest to him. Seeing which, Ambrosia said, "Out of courtesy, Signor, I will grant your request as to those you have taken, but it is idle to expect me to abstain from burning the remainder." Vivaldo, who was eager to see what the papers contained, opened one of them at once and saw that its title was Lay of Despair. Ambrosio, hearing it, said, "That is the last paper the unhappy man wrote, and that you may see, Signor, to what an end his misfortunes brought him, read it so that you may be heard, for you will have time enough for that while we are waiting for the grave to be dug."
"I will do so very willingly," said Vivaldo. And as all the bystanders were equally eager, they gathered round him, and he, reading in a loud voice, found that it ran as follows.
Chapter 14, wherein are inserted the despairing verses of the dead shepherd, together with other incidents not looked for. The Lay of Chrysostom. Since thou dost in thy cruelty desire the ruthless rigour of thy tyranny from tongue to tongue, from land to land proclaimed, the very hell will I constrain to lend this stricken breast of mine deep notes of woe, to serve my need of fitting utterance. And as I strive to body forth the tale of all I suffer, all that thou hast done, forth shall the dread voice roll, and bear along shreds of my vitals, torn for greater pain. Then listen, not to dulcet harmony, but to a discord wrung by mad despair, out of this bosom's depths of bitterness, to ease my heart and plant a sting in thine. The lion's roar, the fierce wolf's savage howl, the horrid hissing of the scaly snake, the awesome cries of monsters yet unnamed, the crow's ill-boding croak, the hollow moan of wild winds wrestling with the restless sea, the wrathful bellow of the vanquished bull, the plaintive sobbing of the widowed dove, the envied owl's sad note, the wail of woe that rises from the dreary choir of hell, co-mingled in one sound, confusing sense, let all these come to aid my soul's complaint, for pain like mine demands new modes of song. No echoes of that discord shall be heard where Father Tagus rolls, or on the banks of olive-bordered Betis. To the rocks, or in deep caverns, shall my plaint be told, and by a lifeless tongue in living words, or in dark valleys, or on lonely shores where neither foot of man nor sunbeam falls, or in among the poison-breathing swarms of monsters nourished by the sluggish Nile. For though it be to solitudes remote the hoarse vague echoes of my sorrow sound thy matchless cruelty, my dismal fate shall carry them to all the spacious world. Disdain hath power to kill, and patience dies slain by suspicion, be it false or true. And deadly is the force of jealousy. Long absence makes of life a dreary void. No hope of happiness can give repose to him that ever fears to be forgot, and death inevitable waits in hall. But I, by some strange miracle, live on, a prey to absence, jealousy, disdain, racked by suspicion as by certainty, forgotten, left to feed my flame alone. And while I suffer thus, there comes no ray of hope to gladden me athwart the gloom, nor do I look for it in my despair, but rather clinging to a cureless woe, all hope do I abjure for evermore. Can there be hope where fear is?
Were it well when far more certain are the grounds of fear? Ought I to shut mine eyes to jealousy, if through a thousand heart wounds it appears? Who would not give free access to distrust, seeing disdain unveiled and, bitter change, all his suspicions turned to certainties, and the fair truth transformed into a lie? Oh, thou fierce tyrant of the realms of love, oh, jealousy, put chains upon these hands, and bind me with thy strongest cord, disdain. But woe is me! Triumphant over all, my sufferings drown the memory of you. And now I die, and since there is no hope of happiness for me in life or death, still to my fantasy I'll fondly cling. I'll say that he is wise who loveth well, and that the soul most free is, that most bound in thraldom to the ancient tyrant love. I'll say that she who is mine enemy in that fair body hath as fair a mind, and that her coldness is but my desert, and that by virtue of the pain he sends, love rules his kingdom with a gentle sway. Thus, self-deluding and in bondage sore, and wearing out the wretched shred of life to which I am reduced by her disdain, I'll give this soul and body to the winds, all hopeless of a crown of bliss in store. Thou, whose injustice hath supplied the cause that makes me quit the weary life I loathe, as by this wounded bosom thou canst see how willingly thy victim I become, let not my death, if haply worth a tear, cloud the clear heaven that dwells in thy bright eyes. I would not have thee expiate in aught the crime of having made my heart thy prey, but rather let thy laughter gaily ring and prove my death to be thy festival. Fool that I am to bid thee, well I know, thy glory gains by my untimely end. And now it is the time. From hell's abyss come, thirsting Tantalus, come, Sisyphus, heaving the cruel stone, come, Titius, with vulture, and with wheel Ixion come, and come, the sisters of the ceaseless toil. And all into this breast transfer their pains, and, if such tribute to despair be due, chant in their deepest tones a doleful dirge over a corse unworthy of a shroud. Let the three-headed guardian of the gate and all the monstrous progeny of hell the doleful concert join. A lover dead, methinks, can have no fitter obsequies. Lay of despair, grieve not when thou art gone forth from this sorrowing heart. My misery brings fortune to the cause that gave thee birth. Then banish sadness, even in the tomb.
The Lay of Chrysostom met with the approbation of the listeners, though the reader said it did not seem to him to agree with what he had heard of Marcela's reserve and propriety, for Chrysostom complained in it of jealousy, suspicion, and absence, all to the prejudice of the good name and fame of Marcela. To which Ambrosio replied, as one who knew well his friend's most secret thoughts, "Señor, to remove that doubt I should tell you that when the unhappy man wrote this lay, he was away from Marcela, from whom he had voluntarily separated himself, to try if his absence would act with him as it is wont. And as everything distresses and every fear haunts the banished lover, so imaginary jealousies and suspicions, dreaded as if they were true, tormented Chrysostom. And thus the truth of what report declares of the virtue of Marcela remains unshaken, and with her envy itself should not and cannot find any fault, save that of being cruel, somewhat haughty, and very scornful."
"That is true," said Vivaldo, and as he was about to read another paper of those he had preserved from the fire, he was stopped by a marvellous vision, for such it seemed, that unexpectedly presented itself to their eyes. For on the summit of the rock where they were digging the grave there appeared the shepherdess Marcela, so beautiful that her beauty exceeded its reputation. Those who had never till then beheld her gazed upon her in wonder and silence. and those who were accustomed to see her were not less amazed than those who had never seen her before. But the instant Ambrosio saw her, he addressed her with manifest indignation. "Art thou come by chance, cruel basilisk of these mountains, to see if in thy presence blood will flow from the wounds of this wretched being thy cruelty has robbed of life? Or is it to exult over the cruel work of thy humours that thou art come, or, like another pitiless Nero, to look down from that height upon the ruin of his Rome in embers, or, in thy arrogance, to trample on this ill-fated corpse as the ungrateful daughter trampled on her father Tarquin's? Tell us quickly for what thou art come, or what is it thou wouldst have, for, as I know the thoughts of Chrysostom never failed to obey thee in life, I will make all these who call themselves his friends obey thee, though he be dead."
"I come not, Ambrosio, for any of the purposes thou hast named," replied Marcela, "but to defend myself, and to prove how unreasonable are all those who blame me for their sorrow and for Chrysostom's death. And therefore I ask all of you that are here to give me your attention, for I will not take much time or many words to bring the truth home to persons of sense. Heaven has made me, so you say, beautiful, and so much so that in spite of yourselves my beauty leads you to love me, and for the love you show me, you say, and even urge, that I am bound to love you. By that natural understanding which God has given me, I know that everything beautiful attracts love, but I cannot see how, by reason of being loved, that which is loved for its beauty is bound to love that which loves it. Besides, it may happen that the lover of that which is beautiful may be ugly, and ugliness being detestable, it is very absurd to say, 'I love thee because thou art beautiful, thou must love me though I be ugly.' But, supposing the beauty equal on both sides, it does not follow that the inclinations must be therefore alike, for it is not every beauty that excites love, some but pleasing the eye without winning the affection. And if every sort of beauty excited love and won the heart, the will would wander vaguely to and fro, unable to make choice of any. For as there is an infinity of beautiful objects, there must be an infinity of inclinations. And true love, I have heard it said, is indivisible, and must be voluntary and not compelled. If this be so, as I believe it to be, why do you desire me to bend my will by force, for no other reason but that you say you love me? Nay, tell me, had heaven made me ugly as it has made me beautiful, could I with justice complain of you for not loving me? Moreover, you must remember that the beauty I possess was no choice of mine, for be it what it may, heaven of its bounty gave it me without my asking or choosing it. And as the viper, though it kills with it, does not deserve to be blamed for the poison it carries, as it is a gift of nature, neither do I deserve reproach for being beautiful. For beauty in a modest woman is like fire at a distance or a sharp sword. The one does not burn, the other does not cut those who do not come too near. Honour and virtue are the ornaments of the mind, without which the body, though it be so, has no right to pass for beautiful. But if modesty is one of the virtues that specially lend a grace and charm to mind and body, why should she who is loved for her beauty part with it to gratify one who, for his pleasure alone, strives with all his might and energy to rob her of it? I was born free, and that I might live in freedom I chose the solitude of the fields. In the trees of the mountains I find society. The clear waters of the brooks are my mirrors, and to the trees and waters I make known my thoughts and charms. I'm a fire afar off, a sword laid aside. Those whom I have inspired with love by letting them see me, I have by words undeceived, and if their longings live on hope, and I have given none to Chrysostom or to any other, it cannot justly be said that the death of any is my doing, for it was rather his own obstinacy than my cruelty that killed him. And if it be made a charge against me that his wishes were honourable, and that therefore I was bound to yield to them, I answer that when on this very spot where now his grave is made, he declared to me his purity of purpose, I told him that mine was to live in perpetual solitude, and that the earth alone should enjoy the fruits of my retirement and the spoils of my beauty. And if, after this open avowal, he chose to persist against hope and steer against the wind, what wonder is it that he should sink in the depths of his infatuation? If I had encouraged him, I should be false. If I had gratified him, I should have acted against my own better resolution and purpose. He was persistent in spite of warning. He despaired without being hated. Bethink you now, if it be reasonable that his suffering should be laid to my charge. Let him who has been deceived complain. Let him give way to despair, whose encouraged hopes have proved vain. Let him flatter himself, whom I shall entice. Let him boast, whom I shall receive. But let not him call me cruel or murderous, to whom I make no promise, upon whom I practice no deception, whom I neither entice nor deceive. It has not been so far the will of heaven that I should love by fate, and to expect me to love by choice is idle. Let this general declaration serve for each of my suitors in his own account, and let it be understood from this time forth that if anyone dies for me, it is not of jealousy or misery he dies, for she who loves no one can give no cause for jealousy to any, and candour is not to be confounded with scorn. Let him who calls me wild beast and basilisk leave me alone as something noxious and evil. Let him who calls me ungrateful withhold his service. Who calls me wayward, seek not my acquaintance. Who calls me cruel, pursue me not. For this wild beast, this basilisk, this ungrateful, cruel, wayward being, has no kind of desire to seek, serve, know, or follow them. If Chrysostom's impatience and violent passion killed him, why should my modest behaviour and circumspection be blamed? If I preserve my purity in the society of the trees, why should he who would have me preserve it among men seek to rob me of it? I have, as you know, wealth of my own, and I covet not that of others. My taste is for freedom, and I have no relish for constraint. I neither love nor hate any one. I do not deceive this one or court that, or trifle with one or play with another. The modest converse of the shepherd girls of these hamlets and the care of my goats are my recreations. My desires are bounded by these mountains, and if they ever wander hence, it is to contemplate the beauty of the heavens, steps by which the soul travels to its primeval abode. With these words, and not waiting to hear a reply, she turned and passed into the thickest part of the wood that was hard by, leaving all who were there lost in admiration as much of her good sense as of her beauty. Some, those wounded by the irresistible shafts launched by her bright eyes, made as though they would follow her, heedless of the frank declaration they had heard. Seeing which, and deeming this a fitting occasion for the exercise of his chivalry in aid of distressed damsels, Don Quixote, laying his hand on the hilt of his sword, exclaimed in a loud and distinct voice,
"Let no one, whatever his rank or condition, dare to follow the beautiful Marcela under pain of incurring my fierce indignation. She has shown by clear and satisfactory arguments that little or no fault is to be found with her for the death of Chrysostom, and also how far she is from yielding to the wishes of any of her lovers. For which reason, instead of being followed and persecuted, she should in justice be honoured and esteemed by all the good people of the world. For she shows that she is the only woman in it that holds to such a virtuous resolution."
Whether it was because of the threats of Don Quixote, or because Ambrosio told them to fulfil their duty to their good friend, none of the shepherds moved or stirred from the spot until, having finished the grave and burned Chrysostom's papers, they laid his body in it, not without many tears from those who stood by. They closed the grave with a heavy stone until a slab was ready, which Ambrosio said he meant to have prepared, with an epitaph which was to be to this effect: "Beneath the stone before your eyes the body of a lover lies.
In life he was a shepherd swain, in death a victim to disdain. Ungrateful, cruel, coy, and fair was she that drove him to despair. And love hath made her his ally, for spreading wide his tyranny.
They then strewed upon the grave a profusion of flowers and branches, and all expressing their condolence with his friend Ambrosio, took their leave. Vivaldo and his companion did the same, and Don Quixote bade farewell to his hosts and to the travellers, who pressed him to come with them to Seville, as being such a convenient place for finding adventures, for they presented themselves in every street and round every corner oftener than anywhere else. Don Quixote thanked them for their advice and for the disposition they showed to do him a favour, and said that for the present he would not, and must not, go to Seville, until he had cleared all these mountains of highwaymen and robbers, of whom report said they were full. Seeing his good intention, the travellers were unwilling to press him further, and once more bidding him farewell, they left him and pursued their journey, in the course of which they did not fail to discuss the story of Marcela and Chrysostom, as well as the madness of Don Quixote. He, on his part, resolved to go in quest of the shepherdess Marcela, and make offer to her of all the services he could render her. But things did not fall out with him as he expected, according to what is related in the course of this veracious history, of which the second part ends here.
Part 3, Chapter 15, in which is related the unfortunate adventure that Don Quixote fell in with when he fell out with certain heartless Yanguesans. The sage Cide Hamete Benengeli relates that as soon as Don Quixote took leave of his hosts and all who had been present at the burial of Chrysostom, he and his squire passed into the same wood which they had seen the shepherdess Marcela enter, and after having wandered for more than 2 hours in all directions in search of her without finding her, they came to a halt in a glade covered with tender grass, beside which ran a pleasant cool stream that invited and compelled them to pass there the hours of the noontide heat, which by this time was beginning to come on oppressively. Don Quixote and Sancho dismounted, and turning Rocinante and the ass loose to feed on the grass that was there in abundance, they ransacked the saddlebags, and without any ceremony, very peacefully and sociably, master and man made their repast on what they found in them. Sancho had not thought it worth while to hobble Rocinante, feeling sure, from what he knew of his staidness and freedom from incontinence, that all the mares in the Cordova pastures would not lead him into an impropriety. Chance, however, and the devil, who is not always asleep, so ordained it that feeding in this valley there was a drove of Galician ponies belonging to certain Yanguesan carriers, whose way it is to take their midday rest with their teams in places and spots where grass and water abound, and that where Don Quixote chanced to be suited the Yanguesan's purpose very well. It so happened, then, that Rocinante took a fancy to disport himself with their ladyships the ponies, and, abandoning his usual gait and demeanour as he scented them, he, without asking leave of his master, got up a briskish little trot, and hastened to make known his wishes to them. They, however, it seemed, preferred their pasture to him, and received him with their heels and teeth to such effect that they soon broke his girths and left him naked without a saddle to cover him. But what must have been worse to him was that the carriers, seeing the violence he was offering to their mares, came running up armed with stakes, and so belaboured him that they brought him sorely battered to the ground. By this time Don Quixote and Sancho, who had witnessed the drubbing of Rocinante, came up panting, and said Don Quixote to Sancho, "So far as I can see, friend Sancho, these are not knights, but base folk of low birth. I mention it because thou canst lawfully aid me in taking due vengeance for the insult offered to Rocinante before our eyes." "What the devil vengeance can we take?" answered Sancho. "If they are more than 20, and we no more than 2, or, indeed, perhaps not more than 1.5." "I count for 100," replied Don Quixote, and without more words he drew his sword and attacked the Yanguesans, and excited and impelled by the example of his master, Sancho did the same. And to begin with, Don Quixote delivered a slash at one of them that laid open the leather jerkin he wore together with a great portion of his shoulder. The Angessens, seeing themselves assaulted by only two men while they were so many, betook themselves to their stakes, and driving the two into the middle they began to lay on with great zeal and energy. In fact, at the second blow they brought Sancho to the ground, and Don Quixote fared the same way, all his skill and high mettle availing him nothing. And fate willed it that he should fall at the feet of Rocinante, who had not yet risen, whereby it may be seen how furiously stakes can pound in angry boorish hands. Then, seeing the mischief they had done, the Angessens, with all the haste they could, loaded their team and pursued their journey, leaving the two adventurers a sorry sight and in sorrier mood. Sancho was the first to come to, and finding himself close to his master, he called to him in a weak and doleful voice,
"Señor Don Quixote! Oh, Señor Don Quixote!"
"What wouldst thou, brother Sancho?" answered Don Quixote in the same feeble, suffering tone as Sancho.
"I would like, if it were possible," answered Sancho Panza, "your worship to give me a couple of sups of that potion of the fiery blast, if it be that you have any to hand there. Perhaps it will serve for broken bones as well as for wounds."
"If only I had it here, wretch that I am, what more should we want?" said Don Quixote. "But I swear to thee, Sancho Panza, on the faith of a knight-errant, ere 2 days are over, unless fortune orders otherwise, I mean to have it in my possession, or my hand will have lost its cunning. But in how many does your worship think we shall have the use of our feet?"
answered Sancho Panza.
"For myself, I must say I cannot guess how many," said the battered knight Don Quixote. "But I take all the blame upon myself, for I had no business to put hand to sword against men who were not dubbed knights like myself. And so I believe that in punishment for having transgressed the laws of chivalry, the god of battles has permitted this chastisement to be administered to me. For which reason, brother Sancho, it is well thou shouldst receive a hint on the matter which I am now about to mention to thee, for it is of much importance to the welfare of both of us. It is at when thou shalt see rabble of this sort offering an insult, thou art not to wait till I draw sword against them, for I shall not do so at all. But do thou draw sword and chastise them to thy heart's content, and if any knights come to their aid and defence, I will take care to defend thee and assail them with all my might, and thou hast already seen by 1,000 signs and proofs what the might of this strong arm of mine is equal to." So uplifted had the poor gentleman become through the victory over the stout Biscayan. But Sancho did not so fully approve of his master's admonition as to let it pass without saying in reply,
"Señor, I am a man of peace, meek and quiet, and I can put up with any affront because I have a wife and children to support and bring up. So let it be likewise a hint to your worship, as it cannot be a mandate, that on no account will I draw sword either against clown or against knight, and that here before God I forgive the insults that have been offered me, whether they have been, are, or shall be, offered me by high or low, rich or poor, noble or commoner, not accepting any rank or condition whatsoever."
To all which his master said in reply,
"I wish I had breath enough to speak somewhat easily, and that the pain I feel on this side would abate, so as to let me explain to thee, Panza, the mistake thou makest. Come now, sinner, suppose the wind of fortune, hitherto so adverse, should turn in our favour, filling the sails of our desires so that safely and without impediment we put into port in some one of those islands I have promised thee. How would it be with thee if, on winning it, I made thee lord of it? Why, thou wilt make it well nigh impossible through not being a knight, nor having any desire to be one, nor possessing the courage nor the will to avenge insults or defend thy lordship. For thou must know that in newly conquered kingdoms and provinces the minds of the inhabitants are never so quiet nor so well disposed to the new lord that there is no fear of their making some move to change matters once more and try, as they say, what chance may do for them.
So it is essential that the new possessor should have good sense to enable him to govern, and valour to attack and defend himself whatever may befall him. "In what has now befallen us," answered Sancho, "I'd have been well pleased to have that good sense and that valour your worship speaks of, but I swear, on the faith of a poor man, I'm more fit for plasters than for arguments. See if your worship can get up, and let us help Rocinante, though he does not deserve it, for he was the main cause of all this thrashing. I never thought it of Rocinante, for I took him to be a virtuous person and quiet as myself. After all, they say right that it takes a long time to come to know people, and that there is nothing sure in this life. Who would have said that, after such mighty slashes as your worship gave that unlucky knight-errant, there was coming travelling post and at the very heels of them such a great storm of sticks as has fallen upon our shoulders?"
"And yet thine, Sancho," replied Don Quixote, "ought to be used to such squalls. But mine, reared in soft cloth and fine linen, it is plain they must feel more keenly the pain of this mishap, and if it were not that I imagine—"
"Why do I say imagine?"
"No, of a certainty that all these annoyances are very necessary accompaniments of the calling of arms, I would lay me down here to die of pure vexation." To this the squire replied,
"Senor, as these mishaps are what one reaps of chivalry, tell me if they happen very often, or if they have their own fixed times for coming to pass, because it seems to me that after two harvests we shall be no good for the third, unless God in his infinite mercy helps us."
"No, friend Sancho," answered Don Quixote, "that the life of knights-errant is subject to a thousand dangers and reverses, and neither more nor less is it within immediate possibility for knights-errant to become kings and emperors, as experience has shown in the case of many different knights with whose histories I am thoroughly acquainted. And I could tell thee now, if the pain would let me, of some who simply by might of arm have risen to the high stations I have mentioned, and those same, both before and after, experienced divers misfortunes and miseries. For the valiant Amadis of Gaul found himself in the power of his mortal enemy Arcalaus the magician, who, it is positively asserted, holding him captive, gave him more than 200 lashes with the reins of his horse, while tied to one of the pillars of a court. And moreover, there is a certain recondite author of no small authority, who says that the knight of Phoebus, being caught in a certain pitfall which opened under his feet in a certain castle, on falling found himself bound hand and foot in a deep pit underground, where they administered to him one of those things they call clysters, of sand and snow water that well nigh finished him. And if he had not been succoured in that sore extremity by a sage, a great friend of his, it would have gone very hard with the poor knight. So I may well suffer in company with such worthy folk, for greater were the indignities which they had to suffer than those which we suffer. For I would have thee know, Sancho, that wounds caused by any instrument which happen by chance to be in hand inflict no indignity. And this is laid down in the law of the duel in express words. If, for instance, the cobbler strikes another with the last which he has in his hand, though it be in fact a piece of wood, it cannot be said, for that reason, that he whom he struck with it has been cudgelled. I say this, lest thou shouldst imagine that because we have been drubbed in this affray, we have therefore suffered any indignity. For the arms those men carried, with which they pounded us, were nothing more than their stakes, and not one of them, so far as I remember, carried rapier, sword, or dagger. They gave me no time to see that much, answered Sancho, for hardly had I laid hand on my sword when they signed the cross on my shoulders with their sticks, in such a style that they took the sight out of my eyes and the strength out of my feet, stretching me where I now lie, and where thinking of whether all those stake strokes were an indignity or not gives me no uneasiness, which the pain of the blows does, for they will remain as deeply impressed on my memory as on my shoulders. For all that, let me tell thee, brother Panza, said Don Quixote,
that there is no recollection which time does not put an end to, and no pain which death does not remove. "'And what greater misfortune can there be,' replied Panza, "'than the one who waits for time to put an end to it and death to remove it? "'If our mishap were one of those that are cured with a couple of plasters, it would not be so bad. "'But I'm beginning to think that all the plasters in a hospital almost won't be enough to put us right. "'No more of that. Pluck strength out of weakness, Sancho, as I mean to do,' returned Don Quixote. "'And let us see how Rocinante is, for it seems to me that not the least share of this mishap has fallen to the lot of the poor beast.' "'There is nothing wonderful in that,' replied Sancho, "'since he is a knight-errant too. "'What I wonder at is that my beast should have come off scot-free "'where we come out scotched. "'Fortune always leaves a door open in adversity "'in order to bring relief to it,' said Don Quixote. "'I say so because this little beast may now supply the want of Rocinante, "'carrying me hence to some castle where I may be cured of my wounds.' And moreover, I shall not hold it any dishonour to be so mounted, for I remember having read how the good old Silenus, the tutor and instructor of the gay god of laughter, when he entered the city of 100 gates, went very contentedly mounted on a handsome ass. "'It may be true that he went mounted as your worship says,' answered Sancho, "'but there is a great difference between going mounted and going slung like a sack of manure.' To which Don Quixote replied, "'Wounds received in battle confer honour instead of taking it away. "'And so, friend Panza, say no more, but, as I told thee before, "'get up as well as thou canst and put me on top of thy beast "'in whatever fashion pleases thee best, "'and let us go hence ere night come on and surprise us in these wilds.'
"'And yet I have heard your worship say,' observed Panza, "'that it is very meet for knights-errant to sleep in wastes and deserts, "'and that they esteem it very good fortune.'
"'That is,' said Don Quixote, "'when they cannot help it, or when they are in love. "'And so true is this that there have been knights "'who have remained 2 years on rocks, "'in sunshine and shade and all the inclemencies of heaven, "'without their ladies knowing anything of it. "'And one of these was Amadis, when, under the name of Beltenebros, "'he took up his abode on the Peña Pobre for, I know not if it was 8 years or 8 months, "'for I am not very sure of the reckoning. "'At any rate, he stayed there doing penance for I know not what pique "'the Princess Oriana had against him. "'But no more of this, Sancho, and make haste before a mishap like Rocinante's befalls the ass.'
"'The very devil would be in it in that case,' said Sancho.
And letting off 30 ohs, and 60 sighs, and 120 maledictions and execrations on whomsoever it was that had brought him there, he raised himself, stopping halfway, bent like a Turkish bow, without power to bring himself upright. But with all his pains he saddled his ass, who too had gone astray somewhat, yielding to the excessive license of the day. He next raised up Rocinante, and as for him, had he possessed a tongue to complain with, most assuredly he would have attempted to outdo Sancho and his master. To be brief, Sancho fixed Don Quixote on the ass and secured Rocinante with a leading rein, and taking the ass by the halter, he proceeded more or less in the direction in which it seemed to him the high road might be. And as chance was conducting their affairs for them from good to better, he had not gone a short league when the road came in sight, and on it he perceived an inn, which, to his annoyance and to the delight of Don Quixote, must needs be a castle. Sancho insisted that it was an inn, and his master that it was not one but a castle, and the dispute lasted so long that before the point was settled they had time to reach it, and into it Sancho entered with all his team without any further controversy. Chapter 16. Of what happened to the ingenious gentleman in the inn which he took to be a castle. The innkeeper, seeing Don Quixote slung across the ass, asked Sancho what was amiss with him. Sancho answered that it was nothing, only that he had fallen down from a rock and had his ribs a little bruised. The innkeeper had a wife whose disposition was not such as those of her calling commonly have, for she was by nature kind-hearted and felt for the sufferings of her neighbours. So she at once set about tending Don Quixote, and made her young daughter, a very comely girl, help her in taking care of her guest.
There was, besides, in the inn, as servant, an Asturian lass with a broad face, flat head and snub nose, blind of one eye and not very sound in the other. The elegance of her shape, to be sure, made up for all her defects. She did not measure above 3 feet from head to foot, and her shoulders, which overweighted her somewhat, made her contemplate the ground more than she liked. This graceful lass, then, helped the young girl, and the two made up a very bad bed for Don Quixote in a garret that showed evident signs of having formerly served for many years as a straw loft, in which there was also quartered a carrier whose bed was placed a little beyond our Don Quixote's, and though only made of the pack-saddles and cloths of his mules, had much the advantage of it, as Don Quixote's consisted simply of 4 rough boards on 2 not very even trestles, a mattress that for thinness might have passed for a quilt, full of pellets, which, were they not seen through the rents to be wool, would to the touch have seemed pebbles in hardness, 2 sheets made of shield leather, and a coverlet, the threads of which any one that chose might have counted without missing one in the reckoning. On this accursed bed Don Quixote stretched himself, and the hostess and her daughter soon covered him with plasters from top to toe, while Maritornes, for that was the name of the Asturian, held the light for them, and while plastering him, the hostess, observing how full of wheels Don Quixote was in some places, remarked that this had more the look of blows than of a fall. "It was not blows," Sancho said, "but that the rock had many points and projections, and that each of them had left its mark. Pray, Senora," he added, "manage to save some of that dressing, as there will be no want of someone to use it, for my back is rather sore." "Then you must have fallen too," said the hostess. "I did not fall," said Sancho Panza, "but from the shock I got at seeing my master fall, my body aches so that I feel as if I had had 1,000 thwacks. "That may well be," said the young girl, "for it has many a time happened to me to dream that I was falling down from a tower and never coming to the ground, and when I awoke from the dream to find myself as weak and shaken as if I had really fallen." "There is the point, Senora," replied Sancho Panza, "that I, without dreaming at all, but being more awake than I am now, find myself with scarcely less wheels than my master Don Quixote."
"How is the gentleman called?" asked Maritornes the Asturian.
"Don Quixote of La Mancha," answered Sancho Panza, "and he is a knight adventurer, and one of the best and stoutest that have been seen in the world this long time past."
"What is a knight adventurer?" said the lass.
"Are you so new in the world as not to know?" answered Sancho Panza. "Well, then, you must know, sister, that a knight adventurer is a thing that in 2 words is drubbed and then emperor. That is today the most miserable and needy being in the world, and tomorrow will have 2 or 3 crowns of kingdoms to give to his squire."
"Then how is it," said the hostess, "that belonging to so good a master as this you have not, to judge by appearances, even so much as a county?"
"It is too soon yet," answered Sancho, "for we have only been a month going in quest of adventures, and so far we have met with nothing that can be called one, for it will happen that when one thing is looked for, another thing is found. However, if my master Don Quixote gets well of this wound, or fall, and I am left none the worse of it, I would not change my hopes for the best title in Spain."
To all this conversation Don Quixote was listening very attentively, and sitting up in bed as well as he could. And taking the hostess by the hand, he said to her,
"Believe me, fair lady, you may call yourself fortunate in having this castle of yours sheltered by my person, which is such that if I do not myself praise it, it is because of what is commonly said that self-praise debaseth. But my squire will inform you who I am. I only tell you that I shall preserve for ever inscribed on my memory the service you have rendered me, in order to tender you my gratitude while life shall last me. And would to heaven love held me not so enthralled and subject to its laws, and to the eyes of that fair, disdainful mistress, whose name I dare hardly breathe, but that those of this lovely damsel might be the masters of my liberty."
The hostess, her daughter, and the worthy Maritornes listened in bewilderment to the words of the knight-errant, for they understood about as much of them as if he had been talking Greek, though they could perceive they were all meant for expressions of goodwill and blandishments, and not being accustomed to this kind of language, they stared at him, and wondered to themselves, for he seemed to them a man of a different sort from those they were used to. And thanking him in pothouse phrases for his civility, they left him, while the Asturian gave her attention to Sancho, who needed it no less than his master. The carrier had made an arrangement with her for recreation that night, and she had given him her word that when the guests were quiet and the family asleep, she would come in search of him and meet his wishes unreservedly. And it is said of this good lass that she never made promises of the kind without fulfilling them, even though she made them in a forest and without any witnesses present, for she plumed herself greatly on being a lady, and held it no disgrace to be in such an employment as servant in an inn, because, she said, misfortunes and ill luck had brought her to that position. The hard, narrow, wretched, rickety bed of Don Quixote stood first in the middle of this starlit stable, and close beside it Sancho made his, which merely consisted of a rush mat and a blanket that looked as if it was of threadbare canvas rather than of wool. Next to these two beds was that of the carrier, made up, as has been said, of the pack-saddles and all the trappings of the two best mules he had, though there were 12 of them, sleek, plump, and in prime condition, for he was one of the rich carriers of Arevalo, according to the author of this history, who particularly mentions this carrier because he knew him very well, and they even say he was in some degree a relation of his. Besides which, Cide Hamete Benengeli was an historian of great research and accuracy in all things, as is very evident, since he would not pass over in silence those that might have been already mentioned, however trifling and insignificant they might be, an example that might be followed by those grave historians who relate transactions so curtly and briefly that we hardly get a taste of them, all the substance of the work being left in the inkstand from carelessness, perverseness, or ignorance. A thousand blessings, thus, on the author of Tablante de Ricamonte, and that of the other book in which the deeds of the Conde Tomillas are recounted, with what minuteness they describe everything. To proceed, then. After having paid a visit to his team and given them their second feed, the carrier stretched himself on his pack-saddles and lay waiting for his conscientious Maritornes. Sancho was by this time plastered and had lain down, and though he strove to sleep, the pain of his ribs would not let him, while Don Quixote, with the pain of his, had his eyes as wide open as a hare's. The inn was all in silence, and in the whole of it there was no light except that given by a lantern that hung burning in the middle of the gateway. This strange stillness, and the thoughts always present to our knight's mind of the incidents described at every turn in the books that were the cause of his misfortune, conjured up to his imagination as extraordinary a delusion as can well be conceived, which was that he fancied himself to have reached a famous castle, for, as has been said, all the inns he lodged in were castles to his eyes, and that the daughter of the innkeeper was daughter of the lord of the castle, and that she, won by his high-bred bearing, had fallen in love with him, and had promised to come to his bed for a while that night without the knowledge of her parents. And holding all this fantasy that he had constructed a solid fact, he began to feel uneasy, and to consider the perilous risk which his virtue was about to encounter. And he resolved in his heart to commit no treason to his lady Dulcinea del Toboso, even though the Queen Guinevere herself and the dame Quintanona should present themselves before him. While he was taken up with these vagaries, then, the time and the hour, an unlucky one for him, arrived for the Asturian to come, who, in her smock, with bare feet and her hair gathered into a fustian coif, with noiseless and cautious steps, entered the chamber where the three were quartered, in quest of the carrier. But scarcely had she gained the door when Don Quixote perceived her, and sitting up in his bed in spite of his plasters and the pain of his ribs, he stretched out his arms to receive his beauteous damsel. The Asturian, who went all doubled up and in silence with her hands before her, feeling for her lover, encountered the arms of Don Quixote, who grasped her tightly by the wrist, and drawing her towards him, while she dared not utter a word, made her sit down on the bed. He then felt her smock, and although it was of sackcloth, it appeared to him to be of the finest and softest silk. On her wrists she wore some glass beads, but to him they had the sheen of precious orient pearls. Her hair, which in some measure resembled a horse's mane, he rated as threads of the brightest gold of Araby, whose refulgence dimmed the sun himself. Her breath, which no doubt smelt of yesterday's stale salad, seemed to him to diffuse a sweet aromatic fragrance from her mouth. And in short, he drew her portrait in his imagination with the same features and in the same style as that which he had seen in his books of the other princesses, who, smitten by love, came with all the adornments that are here set down to see the sorely wounded knight. And so great was the poor gentleman's blindness that neither touch nor smell nor anything else about the good lass that would have made any but a carrier vomit were enough to undeceive him. On the contrary, he was persuaded he had the goddess of beauty in his arms, and holding her firmly in his grasp, he went on to say in a low, tender voice, "Would that I found myself, lovely and exalted lady, in a position to repay such a favour as that which you, by the sight of your great beauty, have granted me. But fortune, which is never weary of persecuting the good, has chosen to place me upon this bed where I lie so bruised and broken that though my inclination would gladly comply with yours, it is impossible. Besides, to this impossibility another yet greater is to be added, which is the faith that I have pledged to the peerless Dulcinea del Toboso, sole lady of my most secret thoughts, and were it not that this stood in the way, I should not be so insensible a knight as to miss the happy opportunity which your great goodness has offered me." Maritornes was fretting and sweating at finding herself held so fast by Don Quixote, and not understanding or heeding the words he addressed to her, she strove without speaking to free herself. The worthy carrier whose unholy thoughts kept him awake was aware of his doxy the moment she entered the door, and was listening attentively to all Don Quixote said, and jealous that the Asturian should have broken her word with him for another, drew nearer to Don Quixote's bed and stood still to see what would come of this talk which he could not understand. But when he perceived the wench struggling to get free, and Don Quixote striving to hold her, not relishing the joke, he raised his arm and delivered such a terrible cuff on the lank jaws of the amorous knight that he bathed all his mouth in blood, and not content with this, he mounted on his ribs and with his feet tramped all over them at a pace rather smarter than a trot. The bed, which was somewhat unfirm on its feet, unable to support the additional weight of the carrier, crashed to the ground, and at the mighty noise the innkeeper awoke and at once concluded that it must be some brawl of Maritornes's, because after calling loudly to her he got no answer. With this suspicion he got up, and lighting a lamp, hastened to the quarter where he had heard the disturbance. The wench, seeing that her master was coming and knowing that his temper was terrible, frightened and panic-stricken, made for the bed of Sancho Panza, who still slept, and crouching upon it, made a ball of herself. The innkeeper came in, exclaiming, "Where are you, strumpet? Of course this is some of thy work." At this, Sancho awoke, and feeling this mass almost on top of him, fancied he had had a nightmare, and began to distribute fisticuffs all round, of which a certain share fell upon Maritornes, who, irritated by the pain and flinging modesty aside, paid back so many in return to Sancho that she woke him up in spite of himself. He then, finding himself so handled by whom he knew not, raising himself up as well as he could, grappled with Maritornes, and he and she between them began the bitterest and drollest scrimmage in the world. The carrier, however, perceiving by the light of the innkeeper's candle how it fared with his lady-love, quitting Don Quixote, ran to bring her the help she needed. And the innkeeper did the same, but with a different intention, for his was to chastise the lass, as he believed that beyond a doubt she alone was the cause of all this harmony. And so, as the saying is, cat to rat to rope, rope to stick, the carrier pounded Sancho the lass, she him, and the innkeeper her, and all worked away so briskly that they did not give themselves a moment's rest. And the best of it was that the innkeeper's lamp went out, and as they were left in the dark, they all laid on one another in a mass so unmercifully that there was not a sound spot left where a hand could light. It so happened that there was lodging that night in the inn an officer of what they call the Old Holy Brotherhood of Toledo, who, also hearing the extraordinary noise of the conflict, seized his staff and the tin case with his warrants, and made his way in the dark into the room, crying, "Hold!
in the name of the jurisdiction, hold, in the name of the Holy Brotherhood.
The first that he came upon was the pummeled Don Quixote, who lay stretched senseless on his back upon his broken-down bed, and, his hand falling on the beard as he felt about, he continued to cry, "Help for the jurisdiction!" But perceiving that he whom he had laid hold of did not move or stir, he concluded that he was dead, and that those in the room were his murderers, and with this suspicion he raised his voice still higher, calling out, "Shut the inn gate! See that no one goes out! They have killed a man here!" This cry startled them all, and each dropped the contest at the point at which the voice reached him. The innkeeper retreated to his room, the carrier to his pack saddles, the lass to her crib. The unlucky Don Quixote and Sancho alone were unable to move from where they were. The officer on this let go Don Quixote's beard, and went out to look for a light to search for and apprehend the culprits. But not finding one, as the innkeeper had purposely extinguished the lantern on retreating to his room, he was compelled to have recourse to the hearth, where, after much time and trouble, he lit another lamp. Chapter 17, in which are contained the innumerable troubles which the brave Don Quixote and his good squire Sancho Panza endured in the inn, which, to his misfortune, he took to be a castle. By this time Don Quixote had recovered from his swoon, and in the same tone of voice in which he had called to his squire the day before when he lay stretched in the vale of the stakes, he began calling to him now.
"Sancho, my friend, art thou asleep? Sleepest thou, friend Sancho?"
"How can I sleep, curses on it?" returned Sancho discontentedly and bitterly, "when it is plain that all the devils have been at me this night."
"Thou mayest well believe that," answered Don Quixote,
"because either I know little, or this castle is enchanted, for thou must know. But this that I am now about to tell thee thou must swear to keep secret until after my death."
"I swear it," answered Sancho.
"I say so," continued Don Quixote, "because I hate taking away anyone's good name."
"I say," replied Sancho, "that I swear to hold my tongue about it till the end of your worship's days, and God grant I may be able to let it out to-morrow."
"Do I do thee such injuries, Sancho," said Don Quixote, "that thou wouldst see me dead so soon?"
"It is not for that," replied Sancho, "but because I hate keeping things long, and I don't want them to grow rotten with me from overkeeping."
"At any rate," said Don Quixote, "I have more confidence in thy affection and good nature. And so I would have thee know that this night there befell me one of the strangest adventures that I could describe. And to relate it to thee briefly, thou must know that a little while ago the daughter of the lord of this castle came to me, and that she is the most elegant and beautiful damsel that could be found in the wide world. What I could tell thee of the charms of her person, of her lively wit, of other secret matters, which, to preserve the fealty I owe to my lady Dulcinea del Toboso, I shall pass over unnoticed and in silence. I will only tell thee that, either fate being envious of so great a boon placed in my hands by good fortune, or, perhaps, and this is more probable, this castle being, as I have already said, enchanted, at the time when I was engaged in the sweetest and most amorous discourse with her, there came, without my seeing or knowing whence it came, a hand attached to some arm of some huge giant that planted such a cuff on my jaws that I have them all bathed in blood, and then pummeled me in such a way that I am in a worse plight than yesterday when the carriers, on account of Rocinante's misbehavior, inflicted on us the injury thou knowest of. Whence conjecture that there must be some enchanted Moor guarding the treasure of this damsel's beauty, and that it is not for me."
"Not for me either," said Sancho, "for more than 400 Moors have so thrashed me that the drubbing of the stakes was cakes and fancy bread to it. But tell me, senor, what do you call this excellent and rare adventure that has left us as we are left now? Though your worship was not so badly off, having in your arms that incomparable beauty you spoke of. But I, what did I have, except the heaviest wax I think I had in all my life? Unlucky me and the mother that bore me! for I am not a knight-errant and never expect to be one, and of all the mishaps the greater part falls to my share."
"Then thou hast been thrashed too?" said Don Quixote.
"Didn't I say so? Worse luck to my line," said Sancho.
"Do not be distressed, friend," said Don Quixote,
"for I will now make the precious balsam with which we shall cure ourselves in the twinkling of an eye."
By this time, the officer had succeeded.